Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and it's great to be with you. Newtown, Vegas, Parkland, Aurora, Orlando, and El Paso. Communities that have experienced mass shootings often have to grapple with an identity shift. How can communities that haven't experienced major incidents of gun violence prepare? How can communities that have work to make sure they never happen again? What options are available in Indiana? We'll hear from experts addressing law enforcement, mental health, and the justice system on mass shootings. Could one happen here? And avow civil conversation. Special thanks to Patty Hayes, Rachel Tobin-Smith, Marilyn Moran Townsend, and Faith Van Gilder for organizing Avow events in our community. And special thanks to Luke Hollinger and his team at Arts United for providing audio for this program. Patty Hayes was the MC for the event, and we'll hear from her shortly to introduce the panelists. Thank you for listening.
Closest to me is Dr. Stephen Ross. Dr. Ross is an experienced forensic psychologist with a demonstrated history of working in the mental health care industry. He is skilled in crisis intervention, clinical supervision, dual diagnosis, psychological assessment, and post-traumatic stress. He's currently president of the Clinical and Forensic Psychological Services of Illinois. He's a graduate of Illinois School of Professional Psychology, Chicago campus, and a member of the American Psychological Association and American Board of Professional Psychology. Dr. Ross. Next to Steve is Mike McAlexander. He's the chief deputy at the Allen County Prosecutor's Office. He's held that office since 2002. He's been, however, with the prosecutor's office since 1984, taking a brief hiatus between 89 and 92 as director of public safety for the city of Fort Wayne. He's had numerous positions as a prosecutor, including felony trial deputy, supervising attorney for child support, juvenile and adult protective services. He's a U.S. Navy veteran and a graduate of IU at Fort Wayne and IU School of Law at Indianapolis. Mike. And on the end is Dottie Davis. Dottie is currently president of Davis Corporate Training and has traveled the country as an expert on the topic of domestic violence, law enforcement response, workplace violence in both areas of prevention and response. She is a passionate advocate who has been a commissioned law enforcement officer with the city of Fort Wayne. She's a graduate of Purdue University and has also served as a board member of many not-for-profits, including Mental Health America, Allen County Drug and Alcohol Consortium, Fort Wayne Sexual Assault Treatment Center, and YWCA of Northeast Indiana. Dottie. Typically, we give each person a chance to talk. They're challenging us with our process tonight. Mike has agreed to start and talking a little around the law. Steve's going to talk about mental health issues as it impacts mass shootings and perpetrators. And Dottie's going to talk a little bit about what do we do? How do we prevent? So we've agreed that Mike's going to start, and I'm going to get rid of my impulsive control issues and step back.
Okay, I guess when I was first given the topic about mass shootings, can they happen here, I thought, well, this is going to be easy. Yes, thank you, good night, we can all go home now. But I think the answer is yes, it can happen here. As we've seen recently, it can happen pretty much anywhere in our country. So what I'd like to do is at least start with a little bit of background on gun laws. Obviously, every time there's a mass shooting, we have a lot of discussion about how can we change the laws to do this? There are a lot of these shootings that a change in the law wouldn't have changed the people that did this. But I did want to just go through a couple of the basics on gun laws. The first one, and maybe kind of interesting for a lot of people that we focus on Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution about the right to keep and bear arms. In Indiana, our Article 2 is a little bit different. It's actually Article 1, Section 32, but its language is a little different. It says in order to maintain, or that the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state. And you compare that with the U.S. Constitution, which talks about a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the state. That's been the subject of interpretation, but we don't really have that as an issue in Indiana. Indiana, in general, has comparatively lax firearm laws. If you're over 18, you're not a felon, you don't have a long history of mental illness, you can probably get a handgun license. You also don't need to have a handgun license to purchase a firearm. We do regulate machine guns, but we don't regulate what are commonly referred to as assault weapons. We are pretty wide open, but our reality is we have very strict laws in a variety of ways regarding guns. Everything from straw purchasers to felons in possession, to not selling to improper people. All of these kinds of things are there. But I always need to remind people that crimes are committed by criminals, and they are not always deterred by the laws that are on the books. So in particular, I think when we look at school shootings, it is always good to remember probably two things, or school shootings or mass shootings. The two biggest parts of those that are common in almost every one of them is, yes, there are guns, but the second thing is they are mentally ill, and they are not following necessarily the laws as written. Just as many of our other more traditional shootings are against the law, usually we don't have the licensed handgun owners that are committing the offenses and the murders that we see on the streets.
Just a few anecdotal things. A couple years ago, I work out at the Y in the morning, and officers from the Fort Meade PD work out there, SWAT team members, and we work out together. And one morning, about 9 o'clock, the Southwest Y, decided to have a fire drill. If anyone's been to the Southwest Y or any Y, what do they tell you to do? If there's a fire or whatnot, you go outside. Usually at this Y, you go out into the front entrance, and we did so. And as we're out there, the officer I'm working out with tells me this would be an ideal place for a shooting. Someone was able to go in and pull the fire alarm, and we, like sheep, we walk outside into the front, and there could have been somebody situated out in the front with an automatic weapon, likely, and would have taken out quite a bit of people. And I hadn't thought about that, as what Mike said, in Fort Wayne, Indiana, the city of churches, but It could happen across the street there at the Fort Wayne Ballet, and it could happen with us leaving right now. I hope the stats are pretty low for that. Secondly, I really don't like to watch news reports on when there is a mass shooter, or when somebody even here in Fort Wayne does a heinous crime, and the reporter or somebody says, they must be really crazy. Because in my parlance, crazy, in your parlance, crazy means they weren't aware of what they were doing, or they must have had some brain injury or something going on. And I think I'll tell you tonight is you don't necessarily need to be mentally ill to be a mass shooter. You just happen to have a weapon, and you happen to have a grudge, and you just happen to have the fortitude, and a little bit of narcissism too. They found in research among mass shooters, or those who perpetrated more than, and a mass shooter, I believe, is by definition 4+ victims, not including the perpetrator. But they found a consistent thread of narcissistic trends, megalomania, meaning very high sense of who they are and what they were trying to accomplish. That was, and universally, mass shooters are male. I don't know of any, unless you folks know, I don't know of any mass shooter who was female, unless those who were overseas who were performing suicide bombings.
The wife of the San Bernardino is the only one I can think of.
Okay.
There's also Dr. Amy Bishop, yeah. Huntsville, Alabama, Harvard grad, neurobiologist, shot 6 of her coworkers, yes, during a Monday morning conference meeting.
And a good point is that we assume that we often think that the mass shooters are those who just go out into a public setting and shoot people. And in that case, with Amy, it was people who she knew. So please don't, if you're in news media, please don't say that they're crazy. I mean, I think I know what crazy is. I mean, they come into my office, but I like to point out the misperceptions and what I call evidence-based facts about mass shooting. They're mass shootings by people with serious mental illness represent the most significant relationship between gun violence and mental illness. Again, there is an illness there to some extent, and we can consider narcissism a mental illness by definition of what the criteria that we use. People with serious mental illness should be considered dangerous. Misconception. Another one, gun laws focusing on people with mental illness or with a psychiatric diagnosis can effectively prevent mass shootings. I don't think changing the gun laws per se is going to do that unless we're going to actually focus on those who are severely mentally ill, and that goes against privacy laws, I believe. Gun laws focusing on people with mental illness or psychiatric diagnosis are reasonable. This is the misperception, even if they add to the stigma already associated with mental illness. So we've got a mentally ill person who, if diagnosed with a bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, which schizophrenia is only common at about 1.2 to 3% of the population. Bipolar illness, manic depression, the old term, is more common. But the research has said that actual shootings of unfamiliar individuals, outside of family members, is very low in the mentally ill, very low, 1%. And when those who have been sent to me by the courts for forensic evaluation, when they've committed a level one or a murder felony, they have a mental illness, but it's usually their ability to get off on the insanity defense is 1% to 2%. Pretty consistent. So if you think that you're going to complete that, you're not. The odds are against you. What we know about evidence-based facts, mass shootings by people with serious mental illness represents less than 1% of all gun-related homicides. Most likely a mass shooting over by a mentally ill person is going to be a suicide. They're more likely to die by suicide than commission of a homicide. Overall contribution of people with serious mental illness to violent crimes is about 3%. Low numbers again. A smaller percentage of them are found to involve firearms. We use the term mass shootings. I think, and you can do this, Dottie, you can do this. I think there's more than just shootings that go on and killing people. Could be bombings. I don't know even if the FBI keeps statistics on mass poisoning, people who've been poisoned in a massive mass factor, but we're focusing on guns. Suicide, firearms and suicide in the United States, evidence overwhelmingly demonstrates that suicide, not homicide, is the most significant public health concern in terms of guns and mental illness. We are now being required, I think some of those statutes will change for mental health providers or providers in general. There is this push about opioids. Physicians have to take 2 hours, I believe, every 2 years or 4 years of opioid addiction CMEs. That's going to change, I believe, for mental health folks, where we're going to be required to take more suicide training. At least in my profession, and I'm on our psychology board as a chairman, we don't require that psychologists take suicide prevention training or acknowledgement training, and that's probably going to change, since that is the major cause of what's going on in shootings by mentally ill people. They're shooting themselves. Few perpetrators of mass shootings have had verified histories of being in psychiatric treatment. Most of the times when you see these histories, or when you have forensic psychiatrists or psychologists take histories of these folks, they've not been in the mental health system. They've been loners. They've been out there. And then the unfortunate thing is they probably did it as a copycat of some sort. They saw it done by somebody else, and they want to megalomania. They want to make themselves look great. They're going to piggyback on someone else's crime. That's been a consistent finding also.
So when I started training on workplace violence prevention around the country, I would tell you that the shooter would be a man, and 98% of them have been men. I would tell you that he would be white. I would tell you that he'd be over 35 and that he would be a loner. And I can sit here today and tell you that I was wrong, because we've had plenty of exceptions to that group that I just defined. What I can tell you is this, that 80% of the time, and I think that number is relatively low, the individual who is about to create havoc on our city, our towns, our country, has told someone, has projected to people what they're going to do beforehand. I just look at the Columbine, the two young men involved in that. They were on the internet for 6 months prior telling people about what they were doing, the videos of themselves with firearms, the video of them with Molotov cocktails. They were telling people about it, and everyone said they were good boys from good families and they would never. And that is where we fail as a society. If you do not have a background in threat assessment, how do you know what they're capable of? You know them in one facet. And so that is why threat assessment teams are extremely important for companies throughout our whole United States, that you have to form a threat assessment team with individuals with a variety of backgrounds. When I was employed at the school corporation, I talked to them about you need to have your nurse there, your athletic director there, you need to have the bus driver there, you need to have all these people that hear and see this student throughout their day, at the end of the day, at the beginning of the day, to see what their triggers are, to see what their buttons are. Because when you all come together, there's a whole lot of knowledge that one person didn't have, but together now you have a better picture. People ask me all the time, is someone dangerous? Well, every single one of us in this room has the potential to be dangerous. No one is dangerous 100% of the time. They can be dangerous in a certain situation, given certain tools, given certain ideas or catalysts, and the more we publicize everything that's happening, those individuals who are contemplating being the next mass killer have now just been like given the idea and given the power, and they want to be next. And so I love the fact that we've trained so well with our law enforcement officers, one we don't name. We just saw the Virginia shooting, and the chief of police got on, that happened June 1st, got on TV and said, I am going to name the assailant one time and one time only, and then we are done talking about him. We're going to talk about how we move forward. We're going to talk about how we're going to pick up the pieces, and that's what we need to do is plan. It drives me absolutely, well, it keeps me awake at night when I hear people talking about if there's going to be an incident, we're going to hide. Hiding and hoping is not a strategy. That is not a plan. So we have got to stop thinking that the table you're sitting at is going to save you, because there is not a table anywhere in this building that is going to save you from a firearm if it's being aimed at you and it's being fired. What we do know is that strategies, when we teach ourselves to mentally prepare for a critical incident before the incident happens, our survivability rates goes up exponentially, because we've played the what-if game with ourselves. My husband's a law enforcement officer. I'm former law enforcement officer. I can tell you we play the what-if game every time we go out for dinner. We hang out with people who are non-law enforcement because, well, it's nice to have normal friends. Sorry. And we're out to dinner with them, and my husband and I will be watching. We always choose where we sit, right? So we can scan the room. We want to see who's coming and going. And we're looking for, like in the old Highlights magazine, what is one of the things that don't fit? Yeah. What doesn't belong here? What is out of the ordinary? And he and I, without saying anything, are having a conversation, and we'll nod, and he's, you got that? Yeah, I got that. Okay. And the other couple, what are they doing? They're clueless. They have no idea of their situational awareness. And unfortunately, where the majority of people are today, and especially our youth, is they are here with some type of electronic device, and they have totally lost their situational awareness. They have no idea of the person who is 2 feet off their shoulder. They have no idea of the person who's just followed them out of the mall to their vehicle. And how many times have you all, show of hands, walked out of a building and forgot where you parked, right? Because you weren't paying attention to where you parked to begin with, because you didn't select your spot. You may not have even remember how you got there. Did I stop at that last stop sign? We are just on autopilot. And we've got to stop doing that, because the clues are there. the people who are going to create this type of havoc, they do not just wake up and snap. I don't care how many times the news media tells you that, it just is not true. They do not just wake up and snap. They've been planning, they've been processing, they've been stockpiling. They're figuring it out, and we're not paying attention. And so that is, if I can get anything across, and every time I do a presentation, people say to me, that was scary. My goal is not to scare people. My goal is to get you all processing information and having a plan before it gets ugly so that you can walk away and help other people survive like you just did.
You know, I think that situational awareness is good for a lot of people in a lot of different ways. I think, how do we translate that into, and what kind of actions can we take when we identify somebody as potentially going along those ways? What steps should schools take? What steps should doctors take from there? Because from the legal standpoint, a lot of people talk about our red flag law. And in Indiana, what that means is if the police have identified you through some circumstance that you have a weapon and you're a danger to yourself or express an imminent threat to yourself or to others, they can come in without a warrant and take any weapons that you have. The legislature recently this year tweaked that law, and it will probably make it more difficult for us to follow through in the long run. We'll still be able to go in and in that immediate crisis point take someone's gun from them. But then when we take it, they have various due process rights that come up rather quickly. And they changed the definition of dangerous this year, that it used to be kind of a two-prong. They were dangerous and they posed an imminent threat, and that was usually when we took the weapon. The second part was they may be dangerous and present a risk of physical injury to themselves or others in the future. Well, they've changed that now to say it is probable that they will do injury to other people or themselves. And the last time I checked, we were not issued a crystal ball to take to court with us and do the eight ball thing to get answers on this stuff. And I don't know how we're going to be able to prove that someone will behave that way in the future. So it may put us more in a position where we have the law, we are going to continue to take those guns, but it may be more difficult to keep that away from them. And this, I think, gets into the whole area that gets into the medical ethics, privacy interests, and that is, once we identify somebody, what do we do with that information, and who should that information be disclosed of? If you're going through a bad time in your life and you go and seek professional help and counseling, should that be held against you for purposes of having a handgun, or should you be on a watch list or something for the next 5 years, 10 years, the rest of your life? And I think those are questions that we haven't really addressed, so I'd be curious to see what you think on the ethics of that.
Well, that really goes to the issue of how well mental health professionals can predict violence. And back in the 60s and the 70s and 80s, it was gospel. If a psychiatrist said that you were going to go out and commit a crime, or even commit a crime, a global, not even identifying what type of crime, then you could have been committed to Richmond State or Logansport State Hospital. In my hometown of Lima, Ohio, it was Lima State Hospital, and I know from working in a psychiatric hospital in the early 80s, that was pretty common practice. Unfortunately, it was inaccurate. Mental health professionals are no more, I hate to put myself out of business here, but no more accurate in categorizing global assessments, global threats, than any one of you at this table. But some practitioners still try to make a living out of it. We have an instrument called the Violence Risk Assessment Guide, VRAG. Anyone here heard about it? You've heard about it? That's those practitioners who do use it. It's an actuarial measure, which means that it purports to say that within 5 years there's a 20% chance of you committing a crime or committing a violent act, or in 50 years or 40 years or whatnot. I'm not a really big fan of actuarial measures because that could stigmatize you and be used against you. I've had it tried to be used in a divorce case where a mother tried to get the husband or the father to have to undergo a threat assessment, so that she can be using that to say that in 10 years you may perpetrate harm against my kid, our kids. But it's misused a lot. I don't do assessments of folks who were denied a gun license. They might have gone to a gun permit. They might have gone somewhere to even purchase a gun, and they were denied. I think it goes to NCIC. Okay, and they were denied, and then they even applied for a gun permit. Indiana State Police processes those, and they deny them. I won't do these evaluations. Because they'll come to me and say, can you prove or show that I am mentally healthy and whatnot? And I'm not willing to do that. I'm not willing to take on that liability. I learned something a couple years ago. I had a 27-year-old fellow come in who said he was denied a gun license. And he asked me to do an evaluation of him to see if he was mentally safe enough to get a license. This was before I stopped doing them. That was based upon a Spillman record. Spillman is a, will you explain Spillman? I know.
Spillman's just a police database that they use.
He, back when he was 16 years old, law enforcement came out to his home. Mother said he was suicidal. That went into Spillman. And then at the age of 27, when he applied for a license, Indiana State Police came up with that. So the question is, should what you do at the age of 16 without a weapon be used against you in trying to procure a weapon down the road? My issue is that our ability to predict is poor. So why do you still use us? We use us to determine the extent of a mental illness and then what type of intervention should take place. Because I won't address issues of whether they should get a gun or not and whether they're going to go out and perpetrate harm against anyone else. I won't entertain those issues.
So there is another piece that's a good predictor of someone who is going to be involved in mass killing, and that is perpetrators of domestic violence. In the last 10 years, we've been looking at the mass killings and what were commonalities, and what we found is that 75% of those Sutherland Springs, that was one down in Texas, what we have found is that not only are they perpetrators of domestic violence, but specifically strangulation as an act. And they are also the same people that are feloniously assaulting or killing law enforcement. So those are two huge predictors that we know. If we hold, and we have laws on our books currently that says if you've been convicted of a crime involving domestic violence, you lose your right to carry or possess for life. It's a federal statute. Now, Indiana law says after 5 years you can have your Second Amendment rights restored. We've not had that test case, to my knowledge. Let me know if we've had a test case. And
we've had some people take advantage of that statute to get their rights restored, but not very many.
Not very many. And you know, everybody says to me, "Why do you think that is? Why haven't more people?" Because we've had that law came into effect in 2003 in Indiana, July 1st, 2003. With thousands of people across the state have been convicted of domestic violence crimes. Why haven't we had more people asking for their Second Amendment right to be restored? You know, I'm not sworn law enforcement anymore, so I can say this. That's because I don't believe they ever gave up their guns to begin with. I believe they still possess them. The courts ask if they have any firearms, and they tell them no. They gave them to their father, their brother. They sold them for a dollar. And the courts do not ask law enforcement officers to go out and retrieve the weapons. Now, if they ask law enforcement, they're bound by the court's order to do so, but that is not common practice across the country. So they still possess, and we see convicted batters in possession of firearms quite often. That's one thing. The other thing is there's a statute that's called Mandate to Prevent Further Violence that I train law enforcement on all the time, and that is that if there's an imminent threat of danger, even if that firearm was not instrumental in today's incident, if there's been a previous threat of that firearm placed to their head, dry fired at them, that the victim can articulate that they have the right to take those firearms into continuity. Now, it may only be for the weekend, but what aren't they doing on Saturday and Sunday? So I love that statute. I think it's one we need to train law enforcement officers on and we need to utilize. But there are people who say, well, he hasn't been convicted of a crime and you're not charging him with anything involving a firearm, so why are you taking their guns? And the phrase is imminent threat of danger. We have to be able to articulate that. So there has to have been something that we can articulate in our report why we believe that to be true. So those are a couple of other predictors that I think we really need to be cognizant of, and we need to talk about with our family members. We need to have open and honest conversations about this so that we do look for those things, and hopefully we'll get people to the table that can address the issue and decide whether or not there needs to be a mental health commitment or some other avenue to deal with it.
Yeah, our local experience with the warrantless seizure of guns, I would say, is roughly running around 75% of the people are threatening to kill themselves. And it's always a determination, are they saying that to gain sympathy? Do they really mean it? I know over the years, I've heard at least people say the ones you have to really be afraid of are the ones that never say they're going to kill themselves.
Yeah,
and they're the greater risk. But in terms of law enforcement, when they're called out because a family member says, I'm really worried about my brother, my husband, my sister, that she or he is threatening to harm themselves, and we come out and we find a gun and we take it and we go through this. And in our experience, we're finding a lot of these people that when they then finally come to court, you know, a couple of weeks, a month later, the people that called in are with them and saying, well, we think he's okay now, so it's okay if you give his gun back. And what we're doing our best, because there obviously was a crisis at one point that brought the loved one to the point where they called for the police to come in, is we're trying to stall that out to protect them from themselves and protect also, if they are serious about it, that they don't turn the gun on the loved one, because that is so common that, I mean, the reality is most of our murders in this community and nationwide are not committed by stranger on stranger. Mm-hmm. It's people you know, and usually family members or business transactions that may be illegal.
You know, another factor I've seen with successful homicides and even suicides is the presence of substance abuse. I believe about maybe 15 years ago, did K2 made its way into at least this community?
I'd say 10. 15.
And there have been a number of murders I've evaluated where the defendant had ingested K2 or spice. And in one in particular, within 2 minutes of his having taken spice, a very powerful drug or illicit drug, he was able to put a ball peen hammer into somebody's head just within 2 minutes. They had a fight over ice cream. And I know it was attributed to the spice, but I think a lot of people who are using guns to commit crimes are perhaps under the influence of some substance. I'll call it chemical courage, something that will lessen or disinhibit them, that they're more likely to pull the trigger. And you're right, Mike is right, that those who really want to commit suicide are not going to talk about it. They're just going to do it. And then maybe after the fact, if they succeed, they're going to try to do it again. There may be some immense, and I think you got to be under extreme pain to want to have to kill yourself. But to do so, to take other people out with you, is one step close to heinous. Well, it is heinous. So.
The next portion of the program will feature a Q&A and talk back from the audience. Thank you for listening to WBOI Presents.
My question is that the focus of tonight is mass shooting, could it happen here? I guess I would pose to you, what can we do as a community to help prevent it from happening here?
That's the see something, say something. You hear someone at work who is, there are a lot of risk factors for workplace violence. And Dr. Ross just said it, 2/3 of those who are going to create homicide in the workplace or under the influence of alcohol or substance. So someone who's coming to work high or drunk, that is someone you cannot be around because it is a huge risk factor. So where's your EAP? Who do you go to in your company to address that issue? In your community, at our churches, You know, do you have a security team at your church? Because you really should have eyes on who's coming in that building. We are a very welcoming environment that is prone for that type of violence. So it's having these conversations and formulating strategies before an incident occurs. We all want to believe it's not going to happen here, and I really hope that it doesn't. But I also want everyone to have a mindset that right now when you come in here, do you know where the exits are? Did you think about that? Where you selected your seat, did you think about, what are things that I can barricade with if I can't get out? If I break this window, or what am I going to break the window with? Is that an exit route? Is that available to me? Those are the things that we want you to start thinking about more broadly and talking to your family members about. You know, how many times have we seen carjackings because people just aren't paying attention? So raising that situational awareness for ourselves and our loved ones.
One other thing. We have roughly, counting all the different police agencies, about 700 police officers in this county. They can't see everything all the time. One thing I think, especially when it comes to potential behaviors, is the social media. And people will put stuff out on social media. They'll say outrageous things that they may not even say to their best friend, but they'll put it out there. Several years ago, we had a stabbing incident at Concordia High School in the middle of the lunchroom. And the young man who did it, we found out later, had put out that to some of his friends, you know, watch out for lunch hour tomorrow. Something's going to happen. Other things, he put out some hints that way. Well, I don't know how many of, you know, teachers, parents, certainly police officers or prosecutors are sitting around watching social media on high school kids to see what's going on. So we really need the folks that are in that kind of community, that peer group, to not be afraid to report that to teachers and school administrators, parents, that kind of thing. You know, it's always hard on this because when you look at the statistical numbers, if we look at every domestic batterer as a potential mass shooter, we get overwhelmed with the numbers because we have so many people committing that crime. And if we look at every teenager who says something stupid, we're overwhelmed, much less adults that say stupid stuff. But somewhere in this, you know, we have to share that information. And I think on some of it, there is a part when you kind of know when it really matters and when it's kind of a joke. But I think we do need to raise that, both the situational awareness, but also our willingness to share when we see somebody doing something.
There's another factor issue that's come up is whether or not games, first shooter games, cause people to go out and want to shoot others. And rap music, whether rap music is promoting violence. If you listen to rap, clearly some of the songs are pretty raunchy, and they're pretty violent. But I can't say that listening to rap music is going to cause you to go out or cause a kid to go out. I do know what the research has said, that for a vulnerable kid or teenager who has some poor impulse control and who may abuse substances, they are more predisposed to acting out on their impulses, getting angry with family, acting out with family, or acting out at school. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to bring a gun to school. But I don't think we can any longer say that watching a video game or a first shooter, active shooter game is going to cause a kid to act out. You got any thoughts, Donnie?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of research on it. Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman, international yep. speaker.
Yep.
He's certainly written a book called Teaching Our Kids to Kill, and he would talk about the desensitization, thank you, that occurs when kids are in front of that screen for hours on end and they, you know, get reality mixed up with fantasy. I can't say. I really, all I know to be true is exactly what Mike just said, and that is working in the schools, building relationships with young people, that kids will come forward and tell you information. We have a lot of university folks here, and I know they work hard also on the university, to get people to come forward with information, even if it's something small, you know, just that post on social media. I think social media is going to be the death of all of us yet with everything that's being put out there, because kids hide behind a keyboard and they say stuff on there, and you really do have to confront and figure out, you know, where is the situation? Is there any cause for concern, or was this just somebody thinking that they were funny? But to not at least look at it, to not have an environment where people don't feel comfortable coming forward, that is going to be where we're going to miss something.
So this is to Dr. Ross and Ms. Davis. Both of you mentioned about substance abuse as maybe one of the reasons, or the research has shown. So my question was, and also alcohol you were talking about. So is it like one-time use just before the incident, or a consecutive subsequent use?
Well, like Dottie said, that there's, if you decide to go out and kill somebody or shoot somebody, you, unless it's a very impulsive act, if you've, there's a lot of foreplanning to it. And my experience from those who, in some cases, have been involved in, that they have smoked marijuana, which happens to be a disinhibiting medication, a drug. I don't care what kind of effect it might have on medical uses, but a lot of criminals I've met with smoke pot, but more so they drink. It disinhibits them, and I think they're more likely to act out. Think about the neurochemistry of alcohol. Clouds your judgment, and what better clouding the judgment than alcohol, which is pretty readily accessible.
I was a hostage negotiator for 7 years with Fort Wayne PD, and I can tell you that we were successful with individuals who were not under the influence to be able to come to a satisfactory resolution. If they had cocaine on board, if they had alcohol on board, we were almost always having to make tactical entry with the SWAT team that we could not negotiate or reason with this individual. I mean, how many of you have ever tried to reason with someone who's intoxicated? It doesn't work. They'll ask you four times why they're going to jail, and you just answered, we're going there because you're intoxicated.
Thank you. I believe we have to work on people's beliefs about stepping up and talking to people, because there's still a belief out there that you don't rat on somebody else because somebody's going to rat on you, and it starts at a very young age. So I think we have to work on that belief that it's more than important. For Dr. Ross, I have 8 grandchildren who are all in junior high and high school now, but since they were in elementary school, they've been doing bad people drills. And how do we, they tell me, after I ask, they don't offer information, is they're scared to go to school. They're scared to go to the bathroom because they know that if they're in a bad bathroom and a bad person comes in, the doors are locked, they have no place to go. So how do we begin those conversations?
Do you counterbalance that with what Mike said? There's 700 officers in this county, right, or this area?
I'm talking rural areas.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what to say to your kids or to the grandkids, other than that we're doing something safety-wise. I heard about in Michigan that they're now building new schools, active shooter schools, that have, they don't have walls like this, but they have certain, what's the word? They have cylindrical walls where you can't really position yourself to shoot somebody. Okay. And so I think, you know, it's what? Transparent, no. They're curved walls where you can't really get a good shot, from what I understand. Up in Michigan, they're doing that. Yeah, because there was a new school in Michigan that did, but think about it. Your kids are going to be aware of why are the walls like that, or they're going to be told. I think we're going to be seeing more anxiety in kids going to school, and the truth is, you can't lie to them. You can't say that you're totally safe. You can't. I think as long as, what I like about it is having SROs in schools, that they, I believe they do provide some protection, assuming that they do act on a threat.
So I would say this. We've been practicing fire drills since 1959 across the country. And it's actually been since 1959 since we've had a fatal school fire. We have got to practice, and I'd really like to get everybody to think differently. We keep talking about active shooter. We need to be talking about armed intruder, because people can be armed with a wide variety of objects. It doesn't have to be a firearm. And if we so narrowly train people to look for a weapon, a firearm, they are not going to see a knife, a bat, any other item that could be used as a weapon against them, they are not going to see that threat because we have trained them mentally to be looking for a weapon. I do believe that we need to do armed intruder trainings with our students, but the problem is that oftentimes law enforcement comes into corporations, schools, and they do some munition training, and they're going to win because they have the tools and the training, and then you all just look like sheep and you fail, and that is not training. What we need to do is mentally prepare people first before we put them under that type of fire, because you have to have that mental preparation. Law enforcement officers, when we do training, we are shot with some munition rounds, but we are taught that to be able to fight through that pain and to know that you can continue the fight. Well, civilians don't have that same background or mindset, and so we're setting them up for failure if we don't first talk them through what it could look like, what it could sound like, what it could smell like, what your options are. And I just go back to, we're training a lot of places, run, hide, fight. Well, hiding is not a strategy. We need to be thinking about avoid, deny, defend. Avoid the situation, get out if at all possible. Your survivability goes up greatly if you are able to get out of the event, because 98% of all of these armed intruders involve one person. But we keep saying there could be multiple people. Statistically, it's just not true. It's not. Now, could there be an exception to that? Yes, of course.
Dottie, you are a great teacher, but I've got a question for you, because you mentioned an evidence-based reality of knowing that domestic violence and the ability to remove firearms following domestic violence doesn't happen. And that makes me angry. If we know that to be true, why don't we proceed with making that happen?
So that is a passion of mine, and obviously being a former law enforcement officer, I've told many, Becky knows this, I've told many victims of crime that the system sucks. Sometimes the criminal justice system doesn't work. Sometimes the social services system doesn't work. And so it does take clarity, and it takes accountability, and it takes awareness for a community to know this information, to ask questions, to put some gentle pressure on how do we make a system change. I do believe that a convicted batter in possession of a firearm is a lethal combination. I just ran the data. My husband can tell you, I just ran the data for 2016, 2017, and the number of domestic violence homicides here in Indiana, and the number one manner was due to firearms. Well, that's not a big surprise, but I think you all would be surprised to know that more men in Indiana are dying in domestic violence situations with firearms than women are almost every single year. And people are like, what? Why are women picking up the guns? No, they're not. They rarely have access to them, knowledge of them, or would not even know if they're loaded. What we are seeing is murder suicides. He is killing her, then killing himself, or he's killing her new boyfriend, and then himself. Or the boys in the household are picking up the firearm and protecting their mother from their abuser, whether it's their biological father, their stepfather, or a revolving door of men coming in that house. So we do need to address that. And I think if we can get men to understand that you have a responsibility to talk about the issue and to have robust conversations around system failure and how do we fix that, I think we would come a long way here in Indiana.
Thanks, Dottie.
You're welcome.
But I also say that when they get a gun as a domestic batter, they're breaking the law at that point.
Correct.
So, you know, if we find them, we arrest a lot of people that are convicted felons or domestic batterers in possession of a handgun, and we prosecute them. It's just, is it enough? And that's where you get into the proportionality of punishment, and how long do you punish somebody for, unfortunately, these very common offenses.
What about the repeat offenders?
Well, all of them are repeat offenders at that stage, right. In terms of if you're a convicted felon or a domestic convicted domestic batterer, you are prohibited from having a handgun.
My question is relative to the mass shootings. Do you have statistics or know of statistics that might point to why there has been such an increase in mass shootings in the last several years, as opposed to we were talking about, you know, when our children or prior years where we didn't have to be so alarmed about mass shootings in schools. Is there any evidence or statistics that point to a greater availability to assault-type weapons or fewer controls on them? What kind of statistics are out there?
So I really believe that we have not seen the increase that everyone believes we have. We know more about it because we get information like that now. Back in the 50s and 60s, you know, we had a party line at our house. The neighbors were on, I'm old, come on. You know, we had a crank telephone, there was one. And we shared a line with our neighbors, and that was how we communicated, and so it wasn't immediate. But we're seeing all types of killings, early 1800s, mass killings, but word didn't travel as well. The news media didn't jump up on it. It didn't hit the news like that. And so there is some data that says there's an uptick, but not much. This has been going on for a long time. We just know more about it today. It's my belief.
One thing that's come up is, why is there more diagnoses of depression or bipolar disorders or whatnot, or schizophrenia? We didn't know what that was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And now with more research in schizophrenia, of course, most schizophrenics do not go out and commit crimes. But one concern was whether there's an over-identification of mental illness or whether it was more of the mental illness. I think that there's not more mental illness, just there's more identification of it. There is more substance abuse. Now, in the past, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, we had alcoholics then. Of course, alcohol back then was much more potent than what it is right now. But a lot of substance abusers I see who are committing crimes are drinking alcohol, and then they're adding something else to it. I think there probably is more identification of what we have, but really the evidence suggests that depression is about 11 to 12% of the population. And of course, if you have someone who died, a family member who died, propensity for depression will go up. But the statistics remain pretty much the same. Bipolar illness is about 4 to 5% of the population.
We know that the children, young children, they don't even have to be talking yet, and throughout the ages and the adolescents that come from the homes of domestic violence are going to be sad, anxious, angry, right? I've seen a lot of those angry young men, and I know that they've ended up in our court system oftentimes. You know, it really does take that village to address. We cannot, in my opinion, be continuing our silos of care or our silos of criminal justice. We have to be looking at family systems, our support systems, whether it's our churches, our schools, and the general community resources, I believe.
I mean, I think most people who work in the criminal justice system are looking at that, and we can pick apart here and there, but it all comes back down to the family. And I think that goes back for all of this, of how much intervention do you want government to enter into those family structures. That's a large part of the question, I think. A lot of the focus on mass shootings has been on the use of weapons, and obviously that's an issue, and that may get into some of the aspects of this, that it seems like more incidents, more people getting killed, and that may be due to the kind of weapons that are used. But the other part of this, in trying to identify the people that are doing it, is the mental health, and how far do we go? I mean, there's a lot of controversy right now about how much Facebook knows about all of us, how much Google knows about of us. If you have an Alexa in your house, you know, I ask you, are you listening to us? But how much, as a society, are we willing to give up of our own privacy, of our mental health records, to be able to identify better who are the people that are likely to do these? I think it was the Sandy Hook killer who was seemingly very protected by his mother, but he had some interactions out there. But he was kind of off the grid for a lot of things. Some of these other people, the Virginia Tech shooter, I believe, bought his guns legally because whatever mental health records he had been sealed. So where are we willing to go? I mean, the debate tends to go, how can we limit the Second Amendment? But it's also, what do we need to do to open up our privacy laws if we're serious about identifying the people that we have the warning signs on, but what kind of database are we willing to create to utilize to identify and monitor if you're going to take it far enough? It's the old Tom Cruise movie, Minority Reports, the Future Crimes Division. I joke that when people ask us in the prosecutor's office why we don't go out and find these people before they do these things, they say, we don't have a Future Crimes Division. We have to wait till they do something before we can prosecute them. But again, I think these are equally valid. If you look at guns on one hand and the availability, you also have to look at the mental health issues and are we doing enough to identify those people?
And I can definitely speak for Fort Wayne Community Schools because they have stepped up to the plate and are doing trauma-informed care with their teachers so that they can recognize students who are more at risk. Dr. Ross can certainly speak to the ACEs study, but adverse childhood experiences is being taught to our case managers and being taught to our counselors that are working with our children so that they recognize kids that have those high scores and how do we intervene with those kids rather than saying, what's wrong with you? It's what happened to you. So that we have a better understanding of what they're bringing to the table and what little suitcase full of luggage or their baggage that they're bringing along with them when they come in.
And to the lady who asked the question about the mass shootings, I'm preparing for this evening. I tried to find some stats on this. The latest I could find was 2017 DOJ. And there was about 39,000 gun-related deaths in the country, of which only 0.3%, less than one half of 1%, were involved in mass shootings. Suicides, 61%, homicides, 37%. And just a note, violent crime in America, in the United States, peaked in 1992 and has been going down ever since. Rifles, including the AR, the AK, and all those bad, nasty guns, including shotguns, accounted for only 2.8% of all the deaths. Fists, knives, and blunt objects were used to kill more people in 2017 than rifles were. The numbers are there. What we're dealing with is not reality necessarily, but the perception of reality. And I think we need to clarify that as much as anything.
So you're a man after my own heart because I love data. So I appreciate very much that you did that research. I couldn't pull that out of my head, so thank you very much for bringing that, sir.
I apologize ahead of time. I don't have television, so I don't know if there are public service announcements regarding a couple things. You know, hey, gun owner, use your gun responsibly. You know, like, because I see those regarding, hey, drinker, drink responsibly. You know, so I just wonder if there's an equivalent. And then I see regarding depression or suicide prevention, I have seen advertisements about, hey, you know, if you're having this sign and this sign and this sign, here's who you call. I just wonder if there is a public service announcement regarding, you know, if you're feeling this, this, and this, or thinking this, this, and this regarding mass shooting, you know, contact X, Y, and Z. And then, so that's one question, that's one part of my question. If not, who would be responsible for creating those? Because I know that I've seen some ads, I know I just said I don't have TV, but I have seen like MAD puts out some PSAs about driving or drinking responsibly. And then the tobacco manufacturers have put out some, you know, PSAs about the dangers. So who would be responsible for creating those if they don't exist? And Why not just create them? Thanks.
Well, I think as far as gun owners, the stats, most of the people that are committing crimes with guns are not buying their guns legally and are not what we would call people with handgun licenses. Most of the folks that are committing our homicides in this community don't have handgun licenses and got their guns probably illegally to start with. I'm not sure how much a PSA telling criminals not to be criminals really works, but certainly in terms of the mental health, I think the general mental health PSAs that say that there's help out there for you. If you're feeling bad, regardless of what it is, and it doesn't have to be tied to a homicide or anything, but I think if you're feeling bad about yourself, that's out there for people to hear about. And I think that stigma that maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago about receiving mental health treatment has in large measure gone away. There are national organizations that promote that. I think it's just not the stigma that it was. If you say, hey, I'm having trouble and I'm going to go see a counselor, whether it's for your marriage or some other reason, I think people are much more accepting of that now than what they were, and some of those PSAs probably do help for that.
I have a question for all of you in here, and then I'll tell you what we have to do, we or those of you who are mental health professionals have to do. But if you had a friend who you knew was very depressed, and very much so that they were vegetative, they really couldn't take care of themselves or whatnot, and if you knew they had a gun or something lethal that they, and then they made vague references about it. I don't know about adults referencing the suicide as much as kids do on social media, but the question would be, what would you do if you knew that your friend was suicidal? How would you reach out? Mental health folks, myself, if we believe that there's a credible, at least for a homicide or hurting somebody, if we believe that there is a credible threat, meaning that I know someone in my office who tells me that they're going to use a gun to shoot Dr. Dave Johnson, then I have to report that to law enforcement. No one would ever do that to you, yet. But no. I'd have to report that. And I have made reports, even when they've told me that they're going to take my license away from me, the person who I had to report. And I just thought to myself, not what better way to lose a license, but yes, you might try that, but I cannot imagine any court that's going to rule against me that I'd made a good faith effort to protect you and to protect the person you were going to make a threat to. I do have people in my office who tell me fairly often they have thought about suicide. And I would say 67% or 70% of folks in this room have thought about that in one way or another. What if you got a bad illness and you, or if you're so depressed, you might consider dying. And whether or not you might consider suicide. But the point is, we'd have to, these kids in high school, in grades, high school and middle school, they hear about that, but you know, they don't want to narc on another kid until it happens, something really egregious happens, and then they say they knew about it. Because I think that's probably where most of the information needs to go to those high school kids who know a lot more than we know.
Let's give everyone, Mike, Steve, and Dottie. Mike, Steve, and Dottie are still going to be here and move around between the tables. Now, it's time for that civil conversation. We've heard a lot of information from different perspectives. What we want you to spend the next 20 minutes, 25 minutes or more, talking about at your table, allowing these three a chance to move through the crowd, is, so what will you do? Can, as a table, you reach one or two common ground elements of things you think would help prevent mass shootings or deal with the risk, if you think it exists, for mass shootings in the city? As a group, come up with one or two. Where can you agree? I think you've heard a couple of things, and then we'll report on out. And if somebody wants to raise their hand and go first to identify, was there any common ground that could be reached on your table?
Yes. Common ground, first of all, we decided collectively that mental health aspect does need to be addressed, that violent crimes, as our experts said, are seldom committed by mental health people. So that is one area that we really need to think about. We also talked about, in particular, disintegration of family and family unit, and so we're really seeing a need for a lot of parents to start parenting, maybe teaching a bit more about how to parent, and that includes responsibility around social media and technology of all sorts. But I think the thing that we really thought was probably the most salient point was that the notion of if you see something, tell someone, and the question always is, well, who do you tell? And so it was suggested that everyone have five authorities, establish a hierarchy. Obviously, first law enforcement, but also other people that you might report to, 211, a pastor, someone else that has some sort of authority. But if everyone had five people that they could think of, so that if the first time you report something, you don't feel it was addressed, you have another place to go to.
Our experts can comment on any of these. Becky, go ahead.
Hello. So the two points that we got that we all came together on were, the first one was doing some education on where people can go when they have mental health issues and how can they deal with the cost of that. A lot of people don't know where they can turn to if they're going through issues or if their friends are going through the issues. And so that's a huge part of what, you know, our great speakers talked about. But, you know, it's a huge problem. You know, schools need to teach it. Adults need to talk about it. It's a conversation that we all need to have and know about. And then the second point that we talked about and agreed on was communicating with legislators and teaching our kids how to reach out to their state elected officials, to their national elected officials, and to their local elected officials about how, you know, we can change laws to educate ourselves more and how citizens can impact the laws that the legislators make and decide upon.
Comment on that. The big question about where to go, and Dottie, you'll know, and I know because I work there. Having Park Center would be my first point of entry for any place, if it's like that, dependent upon where the person is and if they're going to need any type of inpatient psychiatric care. But 481-2700, I mean, I just remember that number all the time, and I've referred folks who may have called me and who have a family member, and maybe people have mixed opinions about how the services they got there, but that's a place to go right off the bat.
The mental health community came together to create toolkits here in Allen County. If you have not seen one of the toolkits, they list all the mental health service providers, how to talk to someone about suicide, how to work with a family who has lost someone to suicide. Those are free toolkits. They are available at Mental Health America, at Stop Suicide Northeast Indiana. Mental Health America is at 1025 West Rudisill. You could stop by there and pick up any of those toolkits. And I know our law enforcement officers, our first responders, are equipped with those, that when they go on a call that is suicide-related, they give those brochures to the family members so that they know where to turn next for additional help.
481-2700, just down here on State Street.
With Park Center and Parkview, with the affiliation, the new walk-in clinic is, I'll never get the address on Lake, but it's across from PBH, that whatever that, Beacon and Lewis Lake. And we do have 24-hour emergency therapist on staff. Doesn't mean that everything gets seen, but there can be emergency assessments there. We do have phone people available, and we do now, on the weekends and in the evenings, have some medical providers with NPs and psychiatrists now there for emergency services. And we are bypassing and starting, for some people who are in critical need and have been off their meds and everything, starting meds before the full psychiatric evaluation. We're doing a backwards.
Is there a different number then, contact number, than what I gave? Okay.
471-9440 is the crisis drop-in clinic. What, I don't know. Why do I have this number?
It's great to know.
Basically, we talked a lot about what Dottie talked about, and that's trauma-informed care and practices. It's really heavily being implemented in school systems, but not necessarily in the community. So we feel like better community awareness, training about trauma-informed care and practices, so as a community we can come together and identify those adverse childhood experiences that are going to impact our little ones all the way up.
So we talked first about just giving hope that a lot of our young people and just period people in general in this day and age don't have a lot of hope. And so if you don't think you have a tomorrow, why are you going to make a good choice for today? And then reporting, taking it serious, even if you don't know if it's a real threat, that's not our job. Our job is to report it. And then the Family Foundation, anything that we can do to build that foundation, rebuild that foundation. So many in our community, they don't have the family support. And then we just talked about communication. We have to be willing to talk about hard topics and be open and honest so we can move forward.
Sure.
In response to lack of hope, Dr. Chad Hellman and Casey Gwynn just published some research on working with children and giving them hope and resiliency. And the book is called Hope Rising, and I encourage everyone to pick it up and read it, because it really just takes one caring adult to come alongside some of our kiddos to get them to where they need to be successful.
Our group focused again on schools. And as we thought about schools, we decided that it's time to bring back the joy of learning and teaching to our public schools, that we need to reach the whole child and teach to the whole child, as opposed to continue to high-stakes testing. We also focused on the ACEs program. There's an excellent movie called Paper Tigers that focuses upon that. We talked about the need for relationships to be developed within the schools, not only with the teacher and the students, but with the peers themselves. I know I've been a teacher at Snyder in the Southside, and while I was at Southside, we had a mediator conflict adult who would come in, and if two students were having a conflict, they would go to him and resolve their issues. And unfortunately, because of funding, again, that got cut. We talked about going down to testify and to support, go to your legislators to support, have them support fully funding public schools, because what these students need, like little kindergartners are needing some recess time. A lot of the programs that keep kids in school and keep them focused are the first ones to get cut, like music and the arts programs, reaching the whole child, the mentally, physically, their whole being with new tools, perhaps like yoga and meditation.
Well, I'm going to be kind of short. There's been a lot of talk about mental health, and obviously that is a key issue. But I don't think that it necessarily takes us away from doing something on a legal basis. And so it tends to be that we have a discussion in two camps. Either you can't take my gun, or we're going to take all the guns. And I think that there is some things that we can do to reduce the lethality of the weapons that are out there, and not only that, the number of weapons that are out there. So, you know, you don't hear of a Thompson submachine gun being used in any of these. You don't hear of a bazooka. Those are weapons that either you need a very high license or you just can't buy them. So I think there are things that can be done and addressed if we can just kind of not go for the whole loaf, but let's go for a few bites.
I was just going to say that we talked about everything that, as it relates to mental illness, and as it relates to the panelists, I have the utmost respect for the ones that are here, and they did an excellent job. But I think the topic was mass shootings. Could it happen here? And we have to look at and see, if you go out to your private companies or wherever you go, if there's a situation, if there's a mass shooting, or if there's an armed intruder that comes into your business, what are you going to do? Have you contacted any one that could come in and do training for your company to help you with the mass shooting? And again, nothing against any of the people that have talked about mental illness, and I think that that's a problem, but I think we're here to talk about the mass shootings and I guess the armed intruders, as well as what Dottie said, but we need to educate ourselves and talk about emergency preparedness as it relates to taking care of the situation. Thank you.
We took a
very high level, we said, first of all, with the guns, initially restricting the sales of assault rifles and weapons, but then we even took it a step further and said we felt we need a program to collect and remove the assault rifles that are in the public domain. The second thing we came up with was a little more positive, but using a positive hero PSA or video for schools, whatever, where somebody's not turning into a rat, but basically helping the child that is promoting the shootings or hurting others.
Indiana does have a prohibition on firearm buyback programs. I can guess, but I never like to really speculate on legislative motives because just the way the legislature works sometimes. I think they felt like if they wanted to do that, they wanted to keep that as a state prerogative and not allow local governments to do that. So it was probably a response to some city or county doing that, and the legislature said, no, that's for us to decide.
I'd like to leave a concluding remark. I think we've had a great civil conversation here. I think we could agree to that, and I think we should give the folks a round of applause for facilitating this. Thank you.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Avow founders Patty Hayes, Rachel Tobin-Smith, Marilyn Moran Townsend, and Faith Van Gilder for organizing this event. And special thanks to Luke Hollinger and his team at Arch United for providing audio for this program. Additional episodes of WBOI Presents can be found at WBOI.org. Our music is by Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our WBOI intern is Monica Blankenship. Until next time, thank you for listening.